At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more. My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Hey guys, this right here is going to be pharmacology, and I'm still trying to figure out how I want to do pharmacology. And yes, I'm halfway through the course and I still don't know how I want to upload it. And it's because pharmacology is such a weird subject. It's either you get it or you don't. There is no middle ground with pharmacology. But I'm just going to upload a drug from a class, for instance, like fluoxetine is an SSRI or metoprolol is a beta blocker. Now, if you need something that is more in depth on a particular drug, then I will let you go and search that out yourself. Like, for instance, metoprolol is a beta blocker. And then labetalol is also a beta blocker, but it is also an alpha blocker as well. So if you guys need that type of particular stuff for a particular drug, then I will let you go out and find that out yourself. But labetalol is also a beta blocker. So you're looking at the apical pulse for 60 seconds. You have your blood pressure guidelines before you can give it and not give it. So stuff like that. I'm probably just going to keep this intro for the rest of the pharmacology drugs out there. That way you guys can know, like, hey, this is an SSRI. This is what SSRIs do. Or this is an SNRI. This is what SNRIs do. Or this is a TCA. This is what TCAs do. Stuff like that. So just because you can really get into the weeds of stuff and then have so many drugs on this podcast that you will never be able to find the right one that you need. So it's just going to be a drug from a drug class. And then if you need more information, like the labetalol example, then that will be on you to be a prudent student, nurse, or whatever it is that you are, to find out what you need to know for your particular nursing school exams or your particular state boards. But I'm just going to be uploading a drug from a class and then letting it ride like that. So I hope you guys enjoy. I'm still trying to figure this stuff out. Thank you for listening. Again, if you like the show, like it. If you want to leave a comment, go for it. Leave a review, whatever. Also check out the ACLS stuff. I uploaded it as well. So if you need ACLS for your work or you need a recert, then by all means, the material that is straight from the AHA's ACLS book is on the podcast, and they go over it. And I even broke it down into certain sections like stroke, like ACS, like respiratory failure, and everything else. Okay. So give that a listen. And as other certifications of mine come due, like PALS and TNCC and ABLS and ASLS and whatever, I'll be uploading those materials too. That way you guys can stop by and listen, and it'll help you out in your practice. But again, this is pharmacology, and this is how I think I'm going to be doing it from now on. So I hope you guys enjoy.
Patient's here.
Oh, boy, got some blood going.
Yeah,
blood. He's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bed. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in the top of the vehicle, was caved in, and she was hanging out parked in front of the window.
She 45 minutes of CPR. We can stop CPR.
6 over.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to take dense, sometimes really technical information and, well, make it usable, fast, clear, actionable.
That's the plan.
Today, our mission is all about pharmacology. we're diving into a classic drug monograph for amitriptyline, you know, Elavil.
Right.
And we're going to reshape it into a high-yield study guide, something really focused on what you need for clinical practice, mm-hmm. for critical care, and, yeah, for nailing those NCLEX-style questions, too.
Absolutely. And amitriptyline, well, it's a fantastic choice for this kind of deep dog. It's a tricyclic antidepressant, a TCA.
An old one, right?
It is. It's foundational. But here's the thing. It's also considered a high-risk medication class. So understanding amitriptyline isn't just, you know, ticking a box for an exam.
No.
It's about getting to grips with a drug that's still widely used, despite newer options, and whose mechanisms, frankly, explain a whole lot about how this entire class of drugs works and the risks involved.
Exactly. So if you're prepping for rounds or exams, or you just need the essential info quickly, this is for you. We're structuring this around, let's call it the triple threat mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, it's surprisingly broad range of uses, and maybe most importantly, the absolute non-negotiable safety priorities.
Yeah, we really need to get beyond just memorizing facts. It's about understanding the why behind the drug's actions, and crucially, knowing what do I do first when things start to go wrong.
Because it really has this duality, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Super versatile on one hand.
And seriously toxic on the other, if you're not careful. So yeah, let's unpack this high-risk classic.
Okay, first things first. What is amitriptyline? Its basic identity.
Right. So its classification is a tertiary amine tricyclic antidepressant. That tertiary amine part of the structure isn't just chemistry jargon. It's actually pretty important for how it works and how it's handled by the body.
Okay, how so?
Well, a key point and something you absolutely need to know is that amitriptyline itself gets metabolized in the liver.
Right.
And one of its major metabolites is nortriptyline.
Which is also a drug.
Exactly. Nortriptyline is also an active antidepressant. It's a secondary amine TCA. And clinically, this is critical. Nortriptyline is actually responsible for most of the norepinephrine reuptake inhibition you see after someone takes amitriptyline.
Oh, so you take one pill, but you essentially get two active drugs working.
Pretty much, yeah. Two active drugs circulating, both with long half-lives, which we'll get into. It complicates things like plasma level monitoring and definitely contributes to its long duration of action and, well, its potential for side effects. It's the first layer of complexity right there.
Got it. Okay, so that leads us to its mechanism of action. We called it the triple threat. It doesn't just do one thing.
No, it hits hard across three main systems. Let's break it down. Threat number one is its main job, the antidepressant effect.
How does that work?
So the immediate effect is that it blocks the reuptake of norepinephrine NE and serotonin. That's 5-HT at the synapse.
So more neurotransmitters hanging around.
Right. You increase the concentration in that synaptic cleft. Now, this immediate boost is likely what causes some of the early side effects. But, and this is a really high yield point, this is not why the person feels better eventually.
Okay.
The actual therapeutic benefit, the mood lift, takes time, weeks, often. And that's because the real antidepressant effect seems to be linked to a slower change. The downregulation of certain receptors in the brain, specifically limbic beta receptors.
Downregulation. Huh. So the receptors become less sensitive over time.
Exactly. The brain adapts to the increased neurotransmitter levels by reducing the number or sensitivity of these receptors. And this adaptation, this downregulation, seems to correlate better with clinical improvement.
Yeah, that takes time.
It takes about 5 to 7 days after you've reached steady therapeutic drug levels in the blood. So you reach the right concentration, and then the clock starts on that receptor chain.
Wow. So that explains the lag. You feel the side effects maybe right away.
Oh, yeah.
But the actual help for depression takes weeks. That's huge for patient counseling, isn't it?
Absolutely critical. You have to tell patients, look, you might feel drowsy or get a dry mouth pretty quickly. Stick with it, because the part that helps your mood takes longer to kick in. Managing those expectations is key for compliance.
Okay. Threat number two. This one causes a lot of the day-to-day complaints, right? Strong anticholinergic effect.
Yes, this is a big one for TCAs, and amitriptyline is particularly potent here. It blocks acetylcholine receptors, muscarinic receptors all over the body, peripherally and centrally.
And that leads to?
That classic constellation of anticholinergic side effects. We're talking very common things like xerostomia, really bad dry mouth,
right.
Blurred vision because it affects the muscles controlling the lens, urinary retention, difficulty peeing, and significant constipation.
That sounds unpleasant.
It is. And these are often the reasons people stop taking the drug. They're the daily management challenge for nurses. But interestingly, as we'll see, this anticholinergic effect is also why it gets used for some surprising off-label indications.
Okay, we'll circle back to that. Now, threat number three, This is the one that makes it really dangerous in overdose, the cardiotoxic effect.
This is probably the single most critical mechanism for anyone in acute care or emergency settings to understand about amitriptyline. It has what's often called a quinidine-like effect on the heart.
Quinidine, that's an antiarrhythmic.
Exactly, a class IA antiarrhythmic. What that means is amitriptyline acts like a potent sodium channel blocker in the cardiac muscle cells.
Okay, sodium channel blocker. So it stabilizes the cell membrane, stops it from firing too much.
It does stabilize it, but by blocking those sodium channels, it significantly slows down how quickly the electrical impulse can travel through the heart muscle. On an ECG, this shows up as a widening of the QRS complex. That QRS widening is a direct sign of sodium channel blockade.
And slowing conduction is bad because...
because it sets the stage for serious problems. It can lead to reentrant arrhythmias where the signal gets stuck in a loop. It can cause severe AV block where the signal from the top chambers doesn't get to the bottom chambers properly. And it's the direct cause of life-threatening ventricular dysrhythmias.
Like VTach.
Ventricular tachycardia, yes, in torsade de pointes. That specific twisting polymorphic VT that's often fatal. This direct cardiotoxicity, sometimes made worse because the drug also potentiates norepinephrine's effects on the heart, is why TCA overdose is such a medical emergency. High mortality risk.
Okay, so given that really serious triple threat profile, you have to wonder why it's still used so much.
It's a fair question.
We know the main FDA-approved indication is major depression in adults, and the dosing reflects the seriousness. Outpatients usually capped at 150 milligrams a day, hospitalized patients maybe up to 300 milligrams.
Correct. That's the official label. But where amitriptyline really shows its, let's say, versatility is in its off-label uses.
This is where things get interesting.
Totally. Because these off-label applications often leverage those secondary mechanisms, the anticholinergic effects, the way it modulates pain, and frequently at much lower doses than you'd use for depression, these are often the real aha moments for learners.
Okay, like what? Pain management seems like a big one.
Huge. You see it prescribed quite a bit for painful diabetic neuropathy.
Nerve pain from diabetes.
Exactly. And also for post-therapeutic neuralgia, that lingering pain after shingles.
And the doses are lower.
Often, yeah. Starting maybe around 25 milligrams once a day, titrating up cautiously, perhaps to 100 milligrams. Guidelines usually classify it as probably effective for these types of neuropathic pain.
How does it help pain? Is it just masking it?
The mechanism isn't fully understood, but it seems distinct from the mood effect. It's thought to work partly by modulating pain signals in the spinal cord, maybe enhancing the body's own natural pain-blocking pathways. It might also improve sleep, which helps with chronic pain perception.
Interesting. We also see it mentioned for headache prophylaxis, specifically for migraines.
Yes, it's used for preventing migraines, though the evidence can be a bit mixed compared to placebo in some studies, but it's definitely in the toolkit. And the sources mention specific dosing for prevention, even in kids and adolescents.
Pediatric dosing. That sounds like something to flag.
Definitely. They mention starting low, like 0.25 milligrams per kilogram per day, maybe going up to 1 milligram per kilogram per day. We absolutely need to remember this context when we talk about cardiac risks in younger patients later on.
Good point. Okay, what else? You mentioned surprising uses.
Right. How about this one? Improving symptoms in diarrhea-predominant irritable bowel syndrome, IBSD.
Wait, an antidepressant for diarrhea? That sounds backwards. Constipation is a side effect, isn't it?
Precisely. That's the therapeutic twist. Think about IBSD. The main problems are gut hypermotility, cramping, urgency, frequent loose stools.
Okay.
And what's amitriptyline's major side effect profile driven by? Strong anticholinergic action.
Oh, blocking acetylcholine.
Slows down gut contractions, reduces secretions. It directly tackles the urgency and the diarrhea. So the very side effect that's a nuisance when treating depression becomes the therapeutic mechanism for IBSD.
That is elegant, so it's actually recommended for that.
Yes. Guidelines often include TCAs like amitriptyline for IBSD, specifically the diarrhea type. Obviously, you would not want to give it to someone with IBS-C, the constipation predominant type. That would make things much worse.
Makes sense. What kind of dose for IBS?
Typically in that lower to mid-range, maybe 50 to 100 milligrams a day.
Fascinating. Any other notable uses?
Well, you see, it mentioned for fibromyalgia, it can help with the widespread pain and often the associated sleep problems.
Okay.
Sometimes it's used just for insomnia at really low doses, like 10 to 50 milligrams, basically just leveraging that sedative side effect.
Right.
And then there are the more niche uses, like persistent singultus. Persistent, intractable hiccups that haven't responded to anything else. The sources mentioned trying 10 milligrams 3 times a day. It just shows how broadly this drug acts systemically.
Wow. Okay.
There's also mention of using it as an adjunct for bulimia nervosa, but honestly, the consensus seems to be that SSRIs generally work better and are tolerated better for bulimia, so TCA use there is pretty limited.
So across all these uses, what counts as success? What are we looking for?
It depends entirely on why you're giving it. For depression, the goal is significant improvement, ideally remission, followed by maintenance therapy for at least 3 months, maybe longer, to prevent relapse.
Okay.
For pain, it's simpler. Reduced pain scores reported by the patient. Does it hurt less?
Makes sense.
And for IBSD, success is symptom relief, less urgency, fewer episodes of diarrhea, better bowel control. The expected outcome has to match the indication.
Let's shift gears to pharmacokinetics, how the body handles this drug.
Yeah.
This stuff is crucial for dosing and safety.
Yeah.
Absorption.
It's absorbed pretty well from the GI tract after you take it orally. But the two key characteristics you really need to burn into your memory are it's highly protein bound in the blood.
Okay.
And it's extremely lipophilic.
Lipophilic meaning fat loving.
Exactly. Fat soluble. And that lipophilicity dictates almost everything about where it goes and how hard it is to get rid of. It means it easily crosses fatty barriers in the body.
Like the blood-brain barrier.
Yep. Gets into the brain easily, crosses the placenta into the fetus, and it gets into breast milk. Its volume of distribution is huge. Meaning it doesn't just stay in the bloodstream. It spreads out and sequesters itself in fatty tissues all over the body.
And that directly impacts its half-life, I imagine.
Absolutely. The half-life is long.
Yep.
And variable. For amitriptyline itself, the parent drug, the range is roughly 10 to 50 hours.
That's already pretty long.
It is. But remember that active metabolite, nortriptyline?
Yeah.
Its half-life is even longer. We're talking 20 to potentially 100 hours.
Wow, up to 100 hours. That's more than 4 days for half it to clear.
Correct. For the active component. So what's the clinical takeaway from these super long half-lives? It's really two main things.
Mm-hmm.
First, the upside. It makes once daily dosing possible, which is generally great for adherence. Patients are more likely to take a med once a day than multiple times.
Right. Convenient.
Second, the downside, the danger. It means that side effects, if they occur, are prolonged. Toxic levels, if reached, stick around for a long time. And withdrawal symptoms, if you stop abruptly, they can be delayed and drawn out.
Delayed withdrawal, how long?
Because the drug clears so slowly, you might not feel withdrawal effects for several days, maybe even a week after stopping. This reinforces why you absolutely must taper this drug off very slowly, gradually reducing the dose over weeks or even months to let the body readjust. No abrupt stops.
Got it. Slow taper is key. What about when to take the dose? The sources seem pretty clear about bedtime dosing being preferred.
Yeah, that's standard practice. And the reason is simple. It's about using a common side effect to the patient's advantage and improving overall compliance and quality of life.
The sedation.
Exactly. Drowsiness is reported in up to 36% of patients, lethargy up to 33%. It's very common. So giving the dose at bedtime means the peak sedative effect happens when they're trying to sleep anyway.
Makes sense. Helps with sleep. Maybe reduces daytime grogginess.
Reduces daytime impairment. Reduces the risk of falls, especially in the elderly when they might be most active. It just makes practical sense.
But is it always bedtime? Is there ever a reason to switch it?
Yes, absolutely. And this is a crucial point for nurses doing follow-up assessments. A minority of patients, maybe around 10% based on some data, have a paradoxical reaction.
Mm.
Instead of sedation, they feel stimulated, agitated, or they get frank insomnia from it.
Okay, so what do you do then?
If a patient reports that this stuff keeps me awake all night, you have to listen. The dose needs to be switched to the morning.
So take it with breakfast instead.
Right. You lose the potential sleep benefit, obviously, but you prioritize them actually being able to tolerate the medication without causing severe sleep disruption. It requires active assessment and adjustment.
Good to know. What about specific patient factors like liver or kidney problems? How is it eliminated?
It's heavily metabolized by the liver. Those CYP450 enzymes are working hard on this one. So if someone has significant hepatic impairment, liver disease.
Use caution.
Definitely use caution. A lower starting dose is usually recommended because they can't clear the drug as effectively, leading to higher levels and increased risk of toxicity. The liver function is really important.
And kidneys.
Interestingly, renal impairment usually doesn't require a specific dose adjustment. Very little unchanged amitriptyline is actually excreted by the kidneys. It gets broken down by the liver first.
Okay, and this brings us back to overdose. We know it's cardiotoxic. So yeah. If someone takes this massive overdose, can you just filter it out with dialysis, like hemodialysis in the ICU?
Ah, that's a critical high yield point. The answer is emphatically no.
Why not?
Remember that high lipophilicity and high protein binding?
Yeah, loves fat, sticks to proteins.
Exactly. It's not floating freely in the watery part of the blood, the plasma, where the dialysis machine could grab it and filter out. It's hiding in the tissues, bound to proteins. The sources are very clear. Hemodialysis is reported as ineffective for removing amitriptyline or nortriptyline.
So in an overdose situation, dialysis is off the table.
Completely. Management is entirely supportive care, aggressive supportive care, airway management, correcting metabolic acidosis, which often happens, treating the seizures if they occur, and managing those life-threatening cardiac dysrhythmias, often with things like sodium bicarbonate. You cannot filter this stuff out.
Okay, let's really focus now on safety, risk prioritization. This is maybe the most critical section for anyone learning about this drug or managing patients on it. We need to think in terms of priorities. Priority one, immediate life-threatening dangers.
Top of the list for priority one has to be the boxed warning about suicidality.
Right. This applies to many antidepressants.
It does. Pooled data from lots of studies showed a statistically significant increase in the risk of suicidal thoughts and behaviors in children, adolescents, and young adults specifically. Patients aged 24 and younger when they first start an antidepressant or when the dose is changed.
Highest risk early on.
Yes, particularly in the first few weeks or a following dose adjustments. Huh. And the risk seems highest in those being treated for major depression itself.
So what is the absolute number one action item related to this warning?
Education and vigilance. Patients, family members, caregivers, whoever is involved must be instructed to watch closely for any emergence or worsening of depression symptoms, any unusual changes in behavior like agitation, anxiety, panic attacks, impulsivity, or any suicidal thoughts or actions.
And report it immediately.
Immediately. To the prescriber. No waiting. This monitoring is absolutely non-negotiable, especially during that initial period before the therapeutic effects on mood have fully developed.
Okay. Priority one, danger one. Suicidality risk. What's the second immediate life threat?
It has to be the cardiovascular complications. This flows directly from that sodium channel blocking mechanism we discussed.
The quinidine-like effects.
Exactly. The most dangerous events are those rapid malignant heart rhythms. We're talking ventricular tachycardia.
You catch.
Torsade de Pointes, which can degenerate quickly into ventricular fibrillation. Complete AV block, leading to potentially fatal bradycardia or a systole. And the sources also mention risk of MI and stroke, likely related to the severe hemodynamic instability these arrhythmias can cause.
What are the warning signs on an ECG? Mm-hmm. What should a nurse be watching for that signals the patient is heading towards one of these catastrophic events?
The key precursors, the things you monitor on the rhythm strip or 12 lead, are prolongation of the QTC interval and the PR interval.
Okay.
These intervals measure electrical conduction time in the heart. Amitriptyline commonly causes some prolongation, but if the QTC interval gets too long generally, a corrected QT interval over 500 milliseconds is considered high risk, the chance of torsade skyrockets.
And the PR interval.
PR prolongation indicates slowing of conduction from the atria to the ventricles heading towards AV block. Also, watching the QRS duration itself. Significant widening of the QRS complex is that direct sign of sodium channel toxicity getting worse. Monitoring these ECG intervals is paramount.
Got it. Priority one, suicidality and cardiac events. Now let's move to priority two. These are severe risks, maybe not always as immediately catastrophic, but still urgent and often requiring stopping the drug.
Right. Urgent priority two. Let's talk CNS first. Seizures are a known risk, even at therapeutic doses, though more common in overdoses.
Okay.
Then you have the potential for major neurotransmitter syndromes. Serotonin syndrome is a big one, especially if combined with other serotonergic drugs.
What does that look like?
Hyperthermia, high fever, muscle rigidity, autonomic instability, wild swings in blood pressure and heart rate, and altered mental status like confusion or agitation.
Yeah.
It's a medical emergency caused by too much serotonin activity.
Okay, what else is CNS?
You can see symptoms resembling neuroleptic malignant syndrome, NMS. This also involves fever, severe lead pipe muscle rigidity, autonomic dysfunction, and altered consciousness. While classically associated with antipsychotics, TCA toxicity can mimic it.
And long-term movement issues.
Yes. Tardive dyskinesia, those involuntary repetitive movements, often of the face and mouth, is a potential long-term risk with chronic use, though perhaps less common than with older antipsychotics. any of these syndromes are red flags to stop the drug immediately.
Okay. What about severe systemic risks, non-cardiac, priority two?
We have to consider rare but potentially fatal hematologic problems like a granulocytosis.
Would you?
A drastic drop in white blood cells, specifically neutrophils, leaving the patient incredibly vulnerable to infection, requires immediate cessation and protective isolation.
Okay.
Also, cases of hepatic failure have been reported, liver toxicity. And then there's DRESS syndrome.
DRESS.
Drug reaction with eosinophilia and systemic symptoms. This is a nasty one. It's a severe delayed hypersensitivity reaction.
Delayed how long?
Often shows up 2 to 8 weeks after starting the drug. It typically involves a widespread rash, fever, swollen lymph nodes, and importantly, inflammation of internal organs like the liver, kidneys, or heart. High eosinophil count in the blood is characteristic. It can be fatal if not recognized and treated promptly by stopping the drug.
Wow, okay. That delay makes it tricky.
Very tricky. Requires a high index of suspicion. These systemic risks are why things like baseline and periodic blood counts, CBC, and liver function tests, LFTs, are often recommended.
And one more priority two link, connecting the common side effects to a severe outcome. Anticholinergic overload causing ileus.
Yes. This is a critical progression to watch for. We know constipation is common, right? Up to 17% incidence. Urinary retention also happens, maybe 4%.
Right. Those are priority three issues usually.
Usually. But if that anticholinergic effect becomes overwhelming, or if constipation isn't managed proactively, the smooth muscle of the gut can essentially become paralyzed. This leads to paralytic ileus.
The bowel just stops moving.
Completely stops. It's a functional obstruction, a life-threatening emergency that can lead to bowel ischemia and perforation. The Source monograph explicitly lists ileus as a potential serious complication. So nurses absolutely have to monitor bowel function, bowel sounds, abdominal distension, last bowel movement, and urinary output very carefully. Don't let simple constipation escalate.
Okay, that perfectly sets up priority three. The common routine monitoring stuff.
Exactly. These are the things you'll encounter most frequently, the quality of life impacts. Top of the list by far is xerostomia dry mouth. Incidence is reported as high as nearly 70%.
That's huge.
It really affects comfort, talking, eating, even dental health long term. Then we have drowsiness and lethargy, which we mentioned for dosing up to 36% and 33% respectively.
And orthostatic hypotension.
Yes, a big one, especially for older adults, up to about 31% incidence. That dizziness or lightheadedness when standing up quickly is a major fall risk. Requires careful blood pressure monitoring, lying, sitting, standing, and patient education.
Other common anticholinergic effects to watch.
Blurred vision, definitely. And reinforcing the need to manage that constipation and watch for early signs of urinary retention before they become severe. These are the bread and butter daily monitoring tasks.
So let's translate all that risk into concrete nursing actions, high yield interventions. Starting back at priority one, cardiac monitoring. How do we operationalize that?
Given the potential for serious cardiac events, including reports of sudden death, especially in younger populations, sometimes using TCAs, routine cardiovascular monitoring is essential. It's not optional.
What does routine mean here? Baseline ECG.
Definitely get a baseline ECG before starting therapy, especially in patients with any pre-existing heart conditions or risk factors, and certainly in children and adolescents.
Yeah.
Then ongoing monitoring is needed, particularly during dose titration or if any symptoms arise.
And what specific things is the nurse assessing during that monitoring?
It's really three core components. First, vital signs. Checking heart rate and blood pressure regularly with specific checks for orthostatic hypotension, measuring BP and pulse lying down, then immediately upon sitting, then immediately upon standing. Look for significant drops in pressure or increases in heart rate.
Okay, vitals. Second.
Second, the ECG itself. Pay close attention to those intervals, the PR interval, the QRS duration, and the QTC interval. Document them. Trend them. Report any significant prolongation or widening immediately. This is where you catch the early warning signs of toxicity.
And third?
Third is patient assessment for symptoms. Ask about palpitations, dizziness, fainting spells, syncope. These could indicate an underlying arrhythmia.
Got it. Vitals, ECG interval, symptoms. Now, how about managing that heavy anticholinergic burden?
This is heavily reliant on patient education and proactive management. For the dry mouth, xerostomia.
Sugar-free gum, sips of water.
Exactly. Frequent sips of water, sugar-free hard candies, or gum to stimulate saliva. Meticulous oral hygiene is also important because chronic dry mouth increases the risk of cavities and gum disease.
And for constipation.
Encourage high fiber intake in the diet, plenty of fluids, physical activity. Stool softeners or even gentle laxatives might be necessary prophylactically for some patients.
And the crucial nursing monitoring piece here.
Assess intake and output. INO, monitor frequency and consistency of bowel movements. Listen for bowel sounds. Are they present? Hypoactive, absent. Palpate for bladder distension if urinary retention is suspected. Any signs of decreasing output or absent bowel sounds need prompt escalation to the provider before it progresses to ileus.
Okay, let's revisit those high-risk populations, pediatrics and pregnancy. What are the key takeaways?
For pediatrics, the main point is that TCAs like amitriptyline are generally not first line for treating depression in children or adolescents anymore. SSRIs are usually preferred due to better safety profiles.
But they're still used sometimes, like for headache.
Yes, they are used off-label, like for migraine prophylaxis, but when they are used in kids, it requires extreme caution. Children's metabolism can be unpredictable, making dosing tricky, and the cardiac risks are a major concern.
So extra careful cardiac screening?
Absolutely, especially if there's any family history of heart disease, sudden cardiac death, or known channelopathies. And you have to be incredibly careful about co-prescribing any other medication that could also prolong the QT interval. Meticulous medication reconciliation is vital.
Okay. What about pregnancy and newborns?
Since amitriptyline is lipophilic and crosses the placenta readily, there are documented risks for the neonate if the mother takes it, especially later in pregnancy.
Risks like what?
Primarily withdrawal symptoms after birth. The baby can show signs like lethargy, irritability, generalized tremors or jitters, sometimes even seizures. Respiratory distress, cyanosis, and significant feeding difficulties have also been reported.
So the baby needs monitoring.
Close monitoring is essential for any neonate exposed in utero. There are also reports of neonatal hypoglycemia. So any baby born to a mother on amitriptyline needs careful observation in the nursery, potentially requiring specialized care.
Right. Okay. Last big category of interventions, drug interactions. Which are the major ones, the potentially deadly combinations learners absolutely must know?
We can link these directly back to the drug's mechanisms. Interaction number one. The risk of serotonin syndrome.
Because amitriptyline boosts serotonin.
Yes, it's a potent serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So if you combine it with other drugs that also increase serotonin, think SSRIs like fluoxetine, sertraline, SNRIs like venlafaxine, the pain med tramadol, triptans for migraines, even St. John's wort.
Too much serotonin.
You risk creating an acute overload of serotonin in the brain synapses. That's serotonin syndrome. Hyperthermia, rigidity, mental status changes. A true medical emergency. Requires stopping the offending agents immediately and supportive care.
And what about MAOIs? That's a classic no-no, right?
The absolute classic contraindication. Combining a TCA like amitriptyline with a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, MAOI, is potentially lethal. You get massive accumulation of neurotransmitter serotonin, norepinephrine, leading to hypertensive crisis, hyperthermia, seizures, coma. Never combine them, and you need a washout period of usually at least 14 days between stopping an MAOI and starting a TCA, or vice versa.
Okay. Deadly combo number one.
Yeah.
Serotonergic agents, especially MAOIs. What's number two?
The cardiotoxicity multiplier effect.
Eating.
We know amitriptyline prolongs the QT interval due to its sodium and potassium channel effects. If you combine it with any other drug that also prolongs the QT interval.
And there are lots of those.
There's a very long list. Certain antibiotics like macrolides, fluoroquinolones, many antiarrhythmics like amiodarone, sotalol, many antipsychotics, even some antifungals and antiemetics. Adding amitriptyline on top dramatically increases the risk of torsade de pointe and sudden cardiac death.
So checking the whole med list for QT prolongers is essential.
Foundational safety check, always.
And the third major interaction area.
Metabolism. Remember, amitriptyline is heavily processed by the liver's CYP450 enzyme system.
Right.
Specifically, two enzymes are key, CYP2D6 and CYP2C19.
Why does that matter?
Because these enzymes can be inhibited or induced by lots of other common drugs. And people naturally have variations in how well these enzymes work. Some are poor metabolizers, some are ultra-rapid metabolizers.
So levels can vary wildly.
Exactly. Take CYP2D6, for example. If a patient is taking amitriptyline and also starts taking a potent CYP2D6 inhibitor like the SSRI fluoxetine Prozac or paroxetine Paxil or the heart drug quinidine.
The inhibitor slows down metabolism.
Right. It blocks the enzyme. So the amitriptyline and crucially the nortriptyline levels start to build up in the patient's system even if they haven't changed their amitriptyline dose at all.
Pushing them into the toxic range.
Potentially pushing them into the cardiotoxic range without anyone realizing the dose was effectively increased by the interaction. It's a silent but potentially deadly interaction. Conversely, CYP inducers could lower levels and cause treatment failure. Managing these CYP interactions is complex but critical.
Okay, that was incredibly thorough, a real deep dive. To help everyone consolidate this, let's boil it down. What are the absolute top five high-yield points that someone needs to take away for clinical practice or for exams?
All right, let's synthesize. These are the core concepts linking mechanism to priority action.
Point number one.
Cardiotoxicity is the primary life-threatening risk, period. Stemming from that quinidine-like sodium channel blockade, this demands vigilant cardiac monitoring baseline ECG, watching QRS duration, QT, and PR intervals, especially in high-risk groups like kids or those on other QT-prolonging drugs.
Okay, number two.
Anticholinergic overload is highly prevalent and potentially dangerous. You will see dry mouth and constipation, high incidence, but you must monitor actively to prevent the progression to the severe complications, urinary retention, and critically paralytic ileus. Intervention focuses on proactive management and monitoring INO and bowel function.
Got it. Number three.
The black box warning mandates immediate behavioral monitoring. Remember the increased risk of suicidality, especially in patients 24 and under, particularly early in treatment or after dose changes. Educate patients and families to report any concerning changes in mood or behavior right away.
Crucial. Number four.
Pharmacokinetics dictate sustained effects and overdose management. That super long half-life, especially of nortriptyline, up to 100 hours, means effects linger, side effects are prolonged, and withdrawal requires a very slow taper. Critically, it also means hemodialysis is useless in overdose due to high lipophilicity and protein binding. Management is supportive.
Right, a dialysis ineffective. And the fifth key takeaway.
Dosing strategy balances efficacy and quality of life. The standard is a single daily dose at bedtime, leveraging the common side effect of sedation to aid sleep and compliance. However, you must assess for the paradoxical reaction stimulation or insomnia and be ready to switch the dose to the morning if that occurs.
Perfect. We started with the dense text of a monograph, and I think we've really built a structured, clinically focused map here. It really shows how understanding that core triple threat mechanism hitting norepinephrine, serotonin, and acetylcholine receptors unlocks everything else.
It really does. It explains the therapeutic uses, even the weird off-label ones, and it directly predicts the most serious safety concerns and the necessary nursing interventions.
It seems like the defining feature of amitriptyline, and maybe TCAs in general, is this sort of therapeutic paradox.
That's a great way to put it. Its lack of specificity, the fact that it hits so many different targets, is what makes it so versatile. Useful for depression, pain, migraines, even IBSD. But that exact same broad-spectrum action that hitting multiple systems is precisely the root cause of its extensive side effect profile and its potential for serious toxicity. Power comes with risk.
Which demands that intense clinical vigilance we've been talking about.
Exactly.
So as you, our listeners, integrate all this, here's a final thought to chew on. When we use amitriptyline at lower doses for things like pain or insomnia, we're often primarily harnessing its secondary effects, right? The sedation, the pain modulation.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that its potent anticholinergic action is the specific reason it works for diarrhea-predominant IBS, how does that deepen your understanding of other TCAs and their differing side effect profiles? And looking forward, could other side effects, if we could control them precisely, potentially become useful therapeutic targets themselves?
It's that tension, isn't it, between broad power and targeted precision in pharmacology. Something to definitely think about.
Indeed. Until the next deep dive, stay curious and above all, stay safe out there.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.